Hi there, esteemed audience, and welcome to another episode of Middle Grade Ninja. I'm your host, Rob Kent. As you know, I'm the author of Fanica Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, which you can get as a paperback and audiobook, and the ebook is free. Free to download whenever you're watching or listening to this, wherever fine ebooks are sold. For more information about me and all of my other books available, plus, more importantly, interviews with authors, literary agents, editors, all the world's best people, available at middlegradeninja.com. My guest this episode, I couldn't be more thrilled to welcome Melissa Hope. Melissa, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Thanks so much for making the time. I was telling you before we got started here, I've been watching your YouTube channel for the past couple of days. And so now I feel like I'm still watching your YouTube channel, but I get to talk back, which is just perfect. esteemed audience, I never summarize other people's books or other people's biographies, and that's how I make sure I keep my friends in the industry. So if you would, give esteemed audience kind of an overview of your background.
Yeah, okay. So my name is Melissa, and I live in Florida. I got a bachelor's degree in English, and I've been writing fiction for about 8 or 9 years. Before that, I was just kind of dabbling in poetry, so I've had a couple poems published for contests, but I just published my first novel, and it's called Sea of Kings. It's a middle grade fantasy adventure about two brothers on a quest to rescue their family from pirates, and it's got monsters, mystery, and a little bit of magic.
So much to talk about. I was looking over your biography earlier, and I noticed that you had moved from Canadian winters to Florida summers, and I was just curious, did you notice that having an impact on your personality, such a drastic change in your climate?
From moving from Canada to Florida?
Yeah, I didn't know if that had brought about like a slightly different version of Melissa. Like, oh, this was what I would have been like if I had been warm all those winters.
It might have. I mean, I did a lot of growing up in that time for a bunch of different aspects of my life. So I definitely feel like I'm a different person. I don't know if the weather made a big change, but I do think the weather influenced my writing for Sea of Kings because I could be in that setting that the book is set in and, like, you know, feel it and smell it and touch it and just really immerse myself into like a tropical world.
That is a wonderful transition. Let's talk about the book. Sea of Kings, we're talking about all kinds of stuff. You've got a powerhouse YouTube channel, Hopeful Happenings, that esteemed audience can check out as soon as they're finished watching us on this channel, obviously, and as soon as they subscribe. Head to Hopeful Happenings. It'll blow your mind. I've got all kinds of questions for you about that, about your social media presence. But let's talk about Sea of Kings, newly available, because you've been working on this book since you came up with the idea in college originally, right?
Yes, so it's been a long time. This was actually the first novel that I completed, and that was years ago. And my husband actually kind of played a part in helping me create the idea for it and work through some of the earlier drafts because he's a marine biologist. And so he was immersed in the ocean from the get-go. And we kind of just collaborated and worked together to write this book.
So did this start off with just kind of a story you were telling each other, or was it a joke that evolved into a story?
Well, when I first met him, he had just returned from the Bahamas. He had been doing an internship there, working for several months with sharks. He'd been tagging like lemon sharks and bull sharks, and just it was actually on an island called Bimini. And he came back just so one of the things about the Bahamas is these little tiny islands, they're some of them are so small that they don't have anything there. So from what I gather, he didn't have like any access to the internet really. And he was just kind of like in this little isolated bubble for several months. So he had a lot of time to think, and one of the things that he thought about was, you know, what if there were kingdoms on each of these tiny islands? What if there were different societies on each of these islands? What would that look like? And when we first met and started dating and everything, he shared that idea with me. And so that was like the initial spark for the book, was the world. What if there were kingdoms on these islands? And then from there, we kind of created the characters, and it was just kind of something fun that we did for a couple years. Finally, I got to the point where I was like, I need to write this down. So, and then it was years later.
Your actual world, as well as now this fantasy world that you're building between you at the start of your relationship.
Yeah, so we've been connected with this book from the very beginning. It's kind of been, it's just been a really cool thing to do with him, because it has nothing to do with our jobs or our like life as parents. It's just like something just for us that we can talk about. And yeah, I'm really happy that we could do it together.
So what does the esteemed audience need to know about the newest and best version, I assume, of the book that's now available from Jellyfish Press?
Well, it just came out. So it came out on April 27th, 2021. And you can get it anywhere. And I really hope that you will check it out and read it. It's fun. It's got tons of action. It's got monsters. And I really put a lot of heart into the whole thing. But like the two main characters are brothers. And I love the relationship that they have. They're the kind of characters that sort of wrote themselves. Maybe you know what I'm talking about, where you just have someone that is so real to you that it just kind of like is natural in the dialogue that comes out. And so that's the two brothers for me. And I really love them. And I just hope that I can share the story with as many people as possible, because I love it so much.
And I know that you're an ardent plotter. Is that right?
I am now.
Was that not true when you started the original draft of Sea of Kings?
No, I did not really know what I was doing when I started Sea of Kings. And that's why it took me so long, is because I kind of had to teach myself how to write a book. I had done a bachelor's degree in English. I'd done creative writing classes. I loved doing that. I read all the time. But for some reason, writing that first book was just really difficult, because I hadn't really had something that was like a straight plan of this is exactly how you write a book. And there isn't always one way to do something, but there are techniques that you can use, and there is a structure that you can use that I had to kind of figure out on my own. But now I just recommend that everybody reads Save the Cat Writes a Novel by Jessica Brody. Well, she rewrote it. It was originally Save the Cat, and then she wrote Save the Cat Writes a Novel, so it was for novelists, but it was originally for screenplays. It's a life changer, that book.
How far into your writing career were you when you finally discovered it?
I had already gotten an agent for Sea of Kings, so it was pretty far into it. And so I had like figured out all of the steps that are in that book, like, you know, the inciting incident and the midpoint and all of these like really crucial points in a story that need to be there. I kind of figured that out on my own by analyzing stories all day long. But I wish I had this years ago, because I could have, you know, saved myself some time.
I mean, some people just have to come up on the rough side of the mountain, I guess. But it's good that you're out there and you're spreading awareness so that other writers will have that, and they'll maybe shave a couple of years off their process. Although I don't know, you have to, what's that Malcolm Gladwell quote, you have to write for however many hours before you get good at it.
Yeah, was it 10,000 hours?
That sounds right.
Yes.
Who would possibly Google that? Yes, it was absolutely 10,000 hours.
Yeah, and I agree with that too, because if I did have this book, I know I could have written a book faster, but I don't know that it would have been the quality that it is now, because I did grow a lot from years and years of writing. And not just this book, I've written a couple other books that haven't been published, but you know, you practice, and practice makes perfect. So just kind of work at it.
So how many drafts from that first draft where you're learning how everything goes to now the full polished version that's out for everybody? Do you have an estimate for how many drafts that would have taken?
It's embarrassingly high. Do you really want to know?
I do, but not if it's going to embarrass you. We can edit this out and move right on.
Okay, well, it's not that embarrassing that you'd have to edit it, but I guess I can say, I don't know the exact number, but it was over, I think it was around, like, 28.
Well, that's not bad at all.
That's not bad?
That's highly reasonable. I don't know. I have to do a lot of rewrites, especially on some of my early projects. I really had to get in there, and I had one that had to be approaching 100 by the time I did all the revisions. So many different agents and editors suggested that ping-ponged around. Plus critique groups, and when you have a book like that that you're writing and rewriting over many years, that is your book that you're kind of learning writing on, 28 drafts is, I think, relatively small.
Okay, that makes me feel better, because I had just been talking to another author who wrote Middle Grade, and she's not on her first book. I think it was like her fifth or something, but she said it took her 4 drafts, and she sounded, it was like a big deal, like, oh, I can't believe it took me 4 drafts. I'm like, yikes, I took way more than 4 drafts to write mine. But
you learn things as you go. Hopefully you get better at it. So for the more recent books that you've written but haven't yet published, how many drafts would you be on for the average there?
Oh, I've only done like two or three drafts for each of those. So I imagine I'll be doing a lot more if I want to start pursuing publishing them.
The other thing, I make this joke a lot, so I apologize to the esteemed audience who's heard it. That's your reward for being a faithful listener. But I would say that if I ever have 2 successful authors look at me and say, Rob, I do this the exact same time every time, and I'm always successful with this method, and another author says that as well, I'm going to throw out everything I know about writing, and I'm doing that from now on. So far, it hasn't happened.
That's a good point. Yeah, everybody is going to get there a different way. So that was just my way. For that book, in fact, I think for even every book, because you published more than one book, was the process different for each one?
Yeah, unfortunately, even books within a series like Banneker Bellend, each one of those had its own unique challenges and its own demands of ways I had to work on it and approach the story. Plus, unfortunately, I change as well. We all do. And, you know, that's one reason I think that you're keen on why writers should finish their first draft within 3 months or so and get it knocked out. Because if you drag on for a year, year and a half, you're a different person. You're in a different mindset by the time you're getting there near the end. Well, over, you know, 3 books, that's, for me, because I'm a bit of a slow writer, that's 3-4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, you change, your writing changes, and you might even forget, like, who the characters are if you wait too long to finish the first draft.
So with Sea of Kings, you start off, I assume you've got a pretty good foundation of world building, because your husband had already been doing a fair amount, and then you started building that together. When do you decide that you want to focus on these brothers? Is it It's Noah and Dagon.
I call him Noah.
I thought, no, there'd be an H there.
What was that?
I wanted to say Noah, but I thought, well, no, there'd be an H there, but it is pronounced Noah.
It is pronounced Noah. At least, I mean, now that I've like published it, it's in the reader's hands. If you want to say it the way you want, that's totally fine. But I pronounce it Noah. I originally had it actually N-O-A-A because that was kind of like a nod to, oh gosh, I'm forgetting the name, but the national or the organization that's basically NASA, but it's for the oceans.
Oh.
My husband's going to kill me for not remembering this name. But
I'm not married to a marine biologist, so I have an excuse.
That's what it was kind of like a nod to.
And I'm, or is that something else?
Yes. I took off the last A, but it, yeah, it's Noah.
Got you. So of all the world building that you did, how did you kind of decide these two brothers and their story, that's where you were going to set the focus of these, this first novel, I assume?
It was early on. So at the very beginning, we knew that we wanted to do like a prince as the main character. And then as I took the story into my own hands and just started writing, right away, this brother came into the story. And it was like, kind of like I said earlier, they kind of just wrote themselves into the story. And I used a lot of inspiration from things that were happening to me at the time, movies I was watching, and then just like my own sibling relationships. And so they kind of evolved over the drafts, but yeah, it was very early on that I brought in Dagon, and he just kind of completed though Noah in a way that like I felt he couldn't do it on his own. So I really liked having their dynamic together.
Was your husband reading drafts as you went and offering input, or did he say, well, no, it's in your hands now and I'll join you at the finish line?
He did read a bunch of drafts for me. But I wrote like I said, I wrote so many drafts that he was like, all right, I think you can just, you know, this is your thing. You can take it, because he did not read all of the drafts, that's for sure. It was definitely something that I took on myself, especially when I got into really thinking about publishing it, because publishing, as you would know, it's like a whole other thing. You have to do a lot of research. You have to, you know who you want to publish with and agents you want to contact. Then you have to go through the process of querying and submissions, and all of that takes a ton of time and effort. So that's when, like, I think it might have been before that I took it on 100%, but definitely when I started thinking about publishing it, I just took it on all myself, because I knew that I'm the one who wanted it published. So I'm the one that was going to go after it.
Somewhere in there, you must have decided the best way to have a publishing expert work on your book was to become a publishing expert yourself. So how did the Hopeful Happenings come about? When did that start?
It's really interesting. You wouldn't think it now, because you have seen me on YouTube and you've seen me maybe on Instagram, so you know that I'm like really out there. But before I was actually like, what's the word? A recluse? I don't know. I was really not involved on the internet at all. After I got married, I cut off all of my social profiles and we went traveling and I wrote books. Like I graduated, all of that happened without any Facebook, Instagram. I think there was something else going on. I can't even remember. There was other profiles. Snapchat? Oh yeah, I missed Snapchat. I never even knew what that was.
That must have been a very peaceful and productive time in your life.
Yeah, it was kind of just like, I want to be in a bubble. And then when I started really thinking about publishing, I talked to someone actually who had published a book, and she kind of gave me a little insider look into what it's like and gave me some references to look up. And one thing that really stuck with me was that this is not going to be something that I can do any longer. If I want to be successful, I need to put myself out there and I need to start branding myself as an author, even before I have a book ready. So I did that a little bit on my own on Instagram, and then it wasn't too long after that that I went like full force into YouTube and Instagram, and I even got a Twitter. Like, I just was like, I'm gonna do this, and it evolved, but I was really, really happy to just meet new people in the writing community, and I was so surprised at how supportive the writing community was. I didn't even know it existed until I jumped into it, and then it was like, wow, these people are doing what I'm doing, or they're a step behind so I can help them, or they're a step ahead so I can learn from them. And I just loved meeting new people, authors, people who love books, bookstagrammers. It was really cool to just get involved in that community.
Did you have, I mean, were you a drama kid in school? Did you have AB club experience?
No, not really. I mean, I did musical theater one time, and I like to sing, so I've been in like choirs, but yeah, I'm not really a drama kid. I feel like I'm an introvert unless I choose not to be, and then I'm very open. But if I have the choice of like going to a party or staying home and watching a movie, I'll usually stay home and watch a movie.
Fair enough. I think most of the writers listening can probably identify. So why, of all the things you could have done, why what made you gravitate toward YouTube?
Well, at the beginning, I didn't know about YouTubers, so I was first discovering what they were. I really liked some of the things that they were doing. And then I actually decided I wanted to do it, but I wasn't sure if it was the right move. So I actually prayed about it, because I'm Christian, so that's something that I believed in, and I just prayed to see if I would feel any different. And I got like a warm feeling in my chest that, you know, this was good. I should go ahead with it if I wanted to. So that's what I did. I felt like this is something that could really help me. And surprisingly, at the time, I had only a couple videos out, but an agent found one of my videos, and I'm telling you, like, there was not hardly any views on this video, like maybe 10. An agent found the video and he contacted me, and we actually ended up working together. So he actually represented me later on. So that was a really cool blessing, because I learned a lot from working with him and getting into that industry with an agent, and also just like all the work that went into it. So I did learn a lot. We did end up parting ways, but I'm really happy that I got to be represented by him at some point. So that was one like immediate blessing of starting YouTube. And then I also just really liked working with different people and meeting them. And I got feedback from people watching how much this was helping them. So that's why I decided to keep going and just keep making more.
That's got to make things easier when you have that assurance, when you feel that God is leading you to use this platform. Plus, you get immediate feedback like that that signals that, yes, everything's going well. Does that take some of the nervousness out of having not been a drama person? I don't know if you've been comfortable speaking in front of people all your life, or is this just something that you just decided, nope, now is the time and I want to do it?
It was kind of a mixture of a couple things. I had not a ton of experience speaking in front of people. I was not a drama kid. But I did take a class, actually, in college that was all about public speaking. And I read the textbook for the class was a book about how to write a speech, essentially. And from that, I really think that's where it started. I kind of realized, I guess I'm like the learner that like needs to read things and see things laid out for me. So when I saw that there was like a formula to creating an engaging speech, that's when I was really happy to just go in and test it out on YouTube. And I felt like I've moved it around a little bit, but I felt a lot more comfortable diving in with that structure behind me. And that was just a college class I took.
So, okay. So you get on YouTube, you realize people are watching you, and that That's fine. It's comfortable. I try to mostly forget that anybody would possibly be watching this, and when I see traffic numbers, I would la la la, I didn't see that. Because it's better. It's just you and me, and we don't worry about anybody that might be watching. It's just our conversation. But you had to have noticed when you've got videos with, 7,000 plus views and other things. At any point, does that make you nervous, or do you have an assurance that, no, this is exactly what I intended to happen or had hoped would happen when I started this, and I felt it was likely to happen? So, wonderful. Or was there a moment of, oh, no, why are so many people suddenly paying attention?
At the beginning, I think it was a little more nerve-wracking, like, oh gosh, someone's actually watching this. But I was really excited about it because I really did want to create a channel that was a place for knowledge and to share the things that I've learned and also to meet new people. So the more people that were watching, I just felt like it was working, and this is what I wanted. I wanted to meet people. And so, yeah, it actually gets me really excited to meet new people and see that people are interested. And I do take note to what they say. Sometimes people will ask for specific videos to be made, so I can give them that. Or if I've already done a video about it, I can, lead them towards what I've already done or give them a short summary of what their question is. And I forget what I'm saying, but it was, yeah, I like it. I really like meeting new people, and I like seeing that there's traffic because that means that it is helping them. And if there was a video that had a lot of views, then I know, okay, people are interested in this subject more so than this other video. So I'm going to do more of what's working. And a lot of that has been picture books and plot structure kind of videos that I found. People are really interested in those. So I like to make more of those because I know that people like it and they're learning from it, which is what I wanted.
Obviously, the agent watches your video and reaches out. That's tremendous. When do you start? How long does it take you regularly posting before you start to see that your audience is growing substantially? Does it happen like over the course of a year? Does it take a little bit longer than that? How long does it take you to grow your audience?
I do think that YouTube is slower than some of the other social platforms. So it's kind of like a slow and steady race, but I also have found that the subscriptions just gently go up, or there might even be a part where they kind of exponentially go up, but they don't go down as much as some other things. Like Instagram is a lot more flaky. You'll be unfollowed and followed constantly, whereas YouTube, it just slowly goes up and up. That's what I've found. So it's slower. You'll have results in a longer period of time, and it's different for different authors, but I found like around a year, I think, is when it started paying off. But yeah, it's nice that it's not so fickle. I can usually count on it continuing to reach new people every day.
So when you sat down, you figured out, okay, well, I'm going to do videos about writing because I want to learn about writing, and that's going to be very useful. When do you decide the format? Is it just I'm going to do speeches and I'm watching and those videos do a little bit better? Are you writing scripts? When you get in the mode and you start making the regular videos that are available and that are popular, what does that look like? How much preparation goes into those videos?
Yeah, that's a great question. I usually will write some sort of script. And it will come from maybe discussions I've had with people online about what they're looking for or things, questions that they've had. I also write things about questions that I've had that I know someone else is going to need this information too, because I had trouble with it, so I know someone else will. So I will sit down and I will do research. I will gather quotes. I will create like a hook and some bullet points. I'm not usually writing word for word what I'll say, but I do have like a rough draft of what I want to say. And then find a day to film and I'll teach it. And I usually do a lot of retakes. So my videos are like cut up a lot because I have so many times where I'm just like, what was I going to say again? Or like a baby starts crying. So it does require a lot of editing, but I do always start with that script and that base to make sure I know that I'm not rambling on camera like I am now.
That's okay. Esteemed audience has come to expect a fair amount of rambling. It's one of the cornerstones of the show. when you start this year, you've got one baby or no babies?
Could you repeat that?
Yeah, when you started YouTube, did you have one baby or no babies?
When I started YouTube, I had one baby. And now I have three.
That's got to make a difference in your video production schedule, how much time you've got. Plus, now you're writing novels the whole time. And it has to be just a tremendous amount of research that goes into every one of these videos, because you're presenting a lot of information compressed into a short time. So how did your schedule look like to manage all of that?
It has definitely changed. It was a lot easier when I only had one baby because I could do it while he was sleeping. Then with my second baby, I kind of had to find a time when my toddler could be engaged or sleeping. And then you might even see in some of my videos that I am holding a baby while I'm talking. She's like on my lap and you might see like the top of her head because I usually don't like to show her face, but you might see a little baby head in there because what can you do if they wake up and you need to film? But with a third, it's been a little bit more difficult. And so that plus COVID and being stuck at home, I have not sent something out too recently, but I am excited to jump back in now that the book launch for Sea of Kings is over and I can focus more on videos that I love making.
Good. I was looking at one of my next questions. This is just a pause because of this whole global pandemic thing, right? This is not, we are going to be seeing more hopeful happens.
Yeah, I do think so. I'd like to make some more videos specifically about Sea of Kings because I'd love to talk more about the characters and go in depth more about the story without giving anything away. I'd really like to do that. And then of course I will go into writing techniques and contests that you can enter and all those kind of things. I do want to jump back into all of that.
So with Sea of Kings, I mean, do you have like some ideas for these are some videos I'm definitely gonna do? Is it gonna be you talking about the book and how you produced the book, or are you gonna do more book trailer type stuff? What do you have in mind?
Well, if I say it on here, that means I have to do it, right?
I'm hoping that's what it means, yes, ma'am. I want to see some great content.
I would really like to hire an illustrator to create some of the characters, and then with those illustrations, or even finding some pictures of actors or something, then I can talk more about like each individual character. And also maybe like, you know, what if Sea of Kings was a movie? Who would be cast in it? And showing those kind of things. Those are fun videos that I've seen other author tubers do before. So I think I'd really like to do that for Sea of Kings.
And would Jellyfish Press be involved somewhat with that? Or would that be mostly a Melissa Hope joint? And then maybe they could come in a little bit later?
That would probably just be me doing that.
Yeah, and then are there plans to expand the Sea of Kings universe? Are we going to see any sequels at some point?
Okay, I really, really want to. I have a whole series planned out, and I would love to continue it. And I've spoken to my publisher already, and so we've talked about what the sequel would look like. But at this point in time, we're just waiting a little bit longer to see if it's something they can do, just because it's a smaller publisher. But yes, I would love to continue the series, and hopefully I can.
So So you are with Jellyfish Press, and I should remind the esteemed audience that if they go back, I didn't write down what episode it is, I think it's somewhere in the 80s. And you can see an interview with Mari Kesselring, who is an editor there. Chatted with her and her husband. Had a wonderful conversation. So look that up. Look up. Watch all the episodes. They're amazing. Did you have any interaction with Mari?
Yeah, she's actually my editor.
Oh, wow. So we've heard her side on how she works with authors. What was your experience working with her?
Oh, she's awesome. She wasn't the editor who originally bought Sea of Kings. I was working with an editor. Her name is Kelsey Thompson, and she ended up taking another job. So she left midway through editing Sea of Kings. So that's why I went with Mari. But all together, like Mari and Kelsey and the whole staff at Jellyfish Press, they're really friendly. They're really on top of things. And they were very supportive of the ideas that I had. And if I had an issue, we would work together. It was really, really nice collaborating with them, with all of them. So I actually had a lot of say in some of the things about the book, like the cover and the pictures on the inside. And so that was really awesome that Mari and the whole team were able to support me in helping me have a say in that.
Well, that is unusual and a nice advantage of working with a closer press like that. What kind of input were you allowed to have into your cover?
So they asked me what I imagined it would be like. And I really wanted to have a scene from the book, and they were 100% supportive of that. I had another idea too, but they were like, we like the scene idea, so we'll go with that. Plus it's more middle grade to have a scene from the book. And then from there, we worked into which scene we should have, and I gave them a couple different examples of scenes that I thought would look good on a cover. And from there, we picked one, and then I like gave them all the details. This is what would be going on in the scene. This is who's in the scene and what they look like and their hair color and what they're wearing and all of that. And then I gave that information to the illustrator, and the illustrator came back with a rough sketch of what you see on the cover. So I was blown away the first time I saw it. I was like, holy cow, this is so cool. And even the words, I suggested that maybe the words could be part of the illustration instead of being like laid on top like a lot of books are. But I did not come up with the smoke being it. That was the illustrator's idea. So they just did like, they took my ideas and made it 100 times better than I could have done myself. So I was really, really just in love with the cover. And I got to see it from beginning of the idea to sketch to final copy. And it was really, really cool to do that.
And did you feel like you, working with a smaller press, did you feel like you were able to mostly maintain, not control, but have a firm say in this book that's going to have your name across the face? That it is the book you intended to put out into the world by the end of the process?
Yes, definitely. I did do a lot of edits with the editors, but this is the book that I wanted. Like they were really good with helping me bring my dream into a reality.
And then in the acknowledgments, you thank beta readers and English students. I'm just curious, how do you get to enlist English students to read the book, and how many are we talking?
Okay, wow, you really did some research here, didn't you? So when I was in college, I got to be in, I took some classes on creative writing, but I also took classes on editing, which is one thing that I'm really grateful I did because it helped me out so much now. And part of editing was we actually found an author at school, like one of the students come in, and she was she let us use her manuscript as like a template for us to edit. And so after doing that and seeing like how much it was beneficial to the author and also just like how much different pieces of feedback you could get from an entire class, I decided to go back after I graduated and I sent in my own manuscript to a class, and I didn't know any of these students. So it's kind of like risky letting so many people read it, but that was a earlier draft. So it was probably a horrible draft, but an entire college class of English editing students got to rip it apart and tell me what works and what doesn't. And it was really cool. It was really cool that they did that. So I'm very appreciative of the work that they put into it.
Since they don't know you, they can be as honest as they care to be, and it's not a concern, right?
Yeah, well, they were nice. They were so nice, but I didn't know any of them, so that was kind of like, it was kind of a leap of faith doing that, because normally I feel like authors like to be more comfortable with who reads their manuscripts, and so I had been doing that, but I just realized I needed to go out of my inner circle and reach out to more people. So I did that. But that was early on. Now I feel like now I've been able to connect with so many different authors that I feel a lot more comfortable reaching out to people in my circle, because I have a lot more editing and author friends in that circle who can give me really good feedback that would help me progress.
So these days when you're writing a book, how many folks get to take a look at the book before you're sending it on to an editor?
I would say about 5-ish people get to look at it. I don't want to make too many people read it at this point. And then also I don't want it to only have like one person's feedback, because that wouldn't be beneficial either. So I try to keep it into like a tighter circle.
And are these like critique partners where you're swapping critiques with them and then you're reading their stuff, or?
Yes, there are a few, there's both. There are a few that will like to read because they read a ton of books. And so they're really good about spotting these problems, but they don't write themselves. And then there are a few who also write. And if they write, I like to try to exchange manuscripts so that we can have that fair, beneficial, mutual, what am I trying to say? The mutual beneficial relationship.
Sounds reasonable to me. That's a good deal, because I'm sure you're giving insightful feedback, and if you're receiving it as well, that's certainly more cost-effective. Although, with your schedule now, I don't know how much, I'm sure there's a higher premium on your time than there was before you had 3 children, and still books to write, and eventually videos to produce again.
Yeah, I suppose I am a lot more busy now, but if I want someone to put a lot of time and effort into helping me with my manuscript, then I'm gonna try to do the exact same thing to them. So I'll definitely have, I make time. I have to make time.
what does your average work day look like?
Ooh, you're putting me on the spot here. Well, I definitely am a mom like the entire day. Usually I might do a little bit of social media in and out during the day, but most of my day I am a mom 100%, and then as soon as they go to bed, it's like boom, what do I need to work on? And I might do some website stuff or writing or reading. I have to actually plan in times to read, because I don't really have just time to sit around on the couch and pull up a book. So I really have to like schedule it in. And so writing, reading, and then marketing. Marketing, actually, I can't believe how much time it takes to do things like that. So I kind of have to find a way to balance all those three main things and then also have a life.
Sure. That's that's important too. So when you're planning time for reading, how much reading do you do? I know you've been a voracious reader most of your life. How much reading are you doing now? How much reading is absolutely essential for a writer that you're blocking in time for?
I don't know that there's a number that I can give, but the more you read, the better, because you just learn more the more you read, and especially reading what you want to write. So if you want to write children's books, then you should be reading children's books. If you want to write mysteries or mystery children's books, like, find those books, and so that you can not only figure out how to write like that, but also knowing what stories are already out there. It'd be a real shame if you had an idea for a book and you took all this time to write the book and then you realized, oh, this already exists. You know, like, that would be horrible. And I've actually talked to people who have told me that they want to write a certain book, and they've told me like what it's about, and I'm like, this is a story that already exists, or this is a huge cliche. You know, like, if they had been reading more, they would have kind of figured that out on their own. So the more you read, the better, but don't look at me as a perfect example, because I'm a little behind on my reading. I'm trying to read a couple debut authors right now, but I just had a baby, so my baby's like 3 months old right now, and so that kind of threw me for a bit, and then I had a launch, so that also pushed me back. But I am really trying to read all of the 2021 debut authors, and right now I am reading, oh gosh, I forgot the name, but I'm reading two books right now by debut authors, and then I also just picked up one from Barnes & Noble the other day for my son that was not a debut book, but it was a graphic novel for middle grade, and it was so funny, so that was one, and it's called The Big Bad Fox. That was a cute one. So I'm like reading here and there, and I read picture books and younger books to my kids all the time. But I do have to, as much as I can, try to find time to read for myself.
Nice thing about writing middle grade, and I know you write picture books as well, is you're spending plenty of time with the target audience, and you can pull up a book and read to them, and that counts. You're nailing, you're excelling at parenting, and you're getting your market research out of the way.
That's true. It's really cool. For picture books, I'm like, I really have read so many picture books. So that's kind of why I'm trying to write some now, because I feel like I've got quite a good base to work from, and it's really fun to work with kids and to read to them. So yes, I don't know if I'm excelling as a parent, but it is really fun to read to my kids. And I actually dedicated the Sea of Kings to my oldest, and he was like, oh, this is for me. I'm like, yeah, so when you're older, you can read it with me. And he's like, let's read it now. So I started reading a little bit to him, and I didn't want to scare him, because there's a little bit of scary parts in there, because he's only 4 years old, but he liked it, and it was so cool to read my own book to my kids. It was a really cool moment.
Well, I think that any parent who is reading to their child is winning the parenting game for at least as long as that's happening. I could be just chaos and madness directly after and directly before, but by God, during that reading time, killing the game. So, I've got lots of questions for you. Something I saw that you had talked about publicly, and so I want to see Douglas to know that I don't think this is an ambush or a gotcha question. If you talk about it publicly, I feel like it's fair game, although you might tell me it's not fair game and we'll just cut it out. But I know that you had an agent that had approached your video originally, and then you secured with a Twitter pitch, who it turned out was not actually, was telling you a story and was not actually submitting your work anywhere. Is that right?
Yeah. So I did have an agent, and They no longer, as far as I know, they no longer do agent work. So I do feel like it's okay to talk about it. If they were still actively an agent, I probably would not say anything because I wouldn't want to affect their career. But from what I know, I think they stopped. So they were representing me and they were awesome. And we went through a first round and so Sea of Kings was actually a young adult originally. And so the first round of submissions was really great. And I got some feedback from these editors. And then after that, I did find out that it was no longer being sent out, even though I was told it was. So that was a bummer. But yeah, like it, in the end, it worked out okay. I realized from the time waiting to hear back that I just wanted to change it anyway. So I changed it to a middle grade and I changed a lot of things about the characters to make them younger and it worked out okay in the end. But it was a little bit of a surprise when I found out that they hadn't been completely honest with me.
The reason I asked this question is not because the name of the show is Let's Explore Your Trauma with Rob. That's not my intention, but I do want to give, because unfortunately these stories come along, not all literary agents are created equal. Obviously, anyone who's been on this show is probably amazing. They all sound amazing, so I assume that they must be. But there are some unscrupulous folks out there. In a situation like that, what were the clues that maybe something was not above board? And what were some things that in retrospect were clear signs that might be warning signs for those listening who might unknowingly be in something of a similar situation?
That's a great question. I mean, there are definitely red flags that you can look for, but the problem is if you do sign on with an agent and you submit a work with them, even if you do find these red flags are happening, you're kind of in a tight spot. So at the beginning, working with this agent, it was great. And then slowly we started, so a red flag would be loss of communication. They're not communicating with you anymore, or they're getting really slow communication. They should be responding to you within a regular business time frame, like 3 to 5 business days is normal. If it's beyond that, if they're taking like a month or two to reply to you, that's really bad. So lack of communication is a big one. And I know that different agents work differently. So there are some like really stellar agents who are good at their job, but they're not great people persons. Like they don't communicate very well, but they're really good at their job. And then there's other people that are really good at communicating and they're almost like your best friend, but they're not so great at their job. So like you kind of have different people and different agencies, so it's hard to say, but lack of communication is a big one to look out for. And then also, if they haven't sold your book within a year, usually I've heard that's you're okay. It's totally fine to part ways with an agent if they haven't sold your book in a year. Some people like to stick it out or change and submit a new book, but I read a lot about this, so I was like, yeah, about a year, it's okay to like say, I'm going to try a different agent or I'm going to take it away. The problem is, though, if you do submit the book to editors with an agent and then choose to pull it out or leave the agent, that book is sort of harder to sell now. So you can sell it, but if you were to go to another agent and you said, hey, I had this agent and I was trying to sell a book. I was trying to sell book A with this agent. Will you take book A and sell it for me? And they already know that someone else tried to sell it. That agent's probably not going to take on the book. At least that's what I found from my personal experience. I don't know if that's true for everybody, but you're better off just submitting a new project.
Did someone else bring this to your attention that this was happening, or how did you come to find out that this was your situation that you were in?
Well, I had a feeling, so I kind of stuck it out because of that sort of catch-22 that I was in. I didn't want to give up on the Sea of Kings book because I loved it so much and I really thought it had potential. But I also realized that I had, you know, lost the connection and the communication there. But it was actually this agent leaving the agency that brought everything to my attention. Because then once they left, I was lumped in with all the clients kind of were like, whoa, what happened? So we kind of were able to get our records back and see the submission history and all that. And that's when I found out. But I was already kind of like, I already knew things were not so great. I just wasn't really telling anybody, you know, because you don't really want, I almost feel bad saying this now. Like, you don't really want to tell people what goes on behind the scenes until something's like final. You don't want to tell anyone that you might be getting a book deal until you have the book deal. You don't want to tell anyone that you're possibly going to work with an agent until you've like signed a contract with that agent. So I didn't say much at the time. And it was only after the fact that I decided to share the story just in case someone else felt the same way that I felt and was wondering if it was just them or if this could be a bigger problem.
No, I completely 100% understand. I mean, frequently it's the case that an author, not frequently, but it is sometimes the case that an author is in a bad relationship with their agent, and what do you do at that point? You don't want to go on Twitter and say, attention, all other agents and folks in publishing who might be paying attention, I'm difficult to work with, and I have thoughts about this person who represents me. Please call me and let's chat and let's get a new deal going. You want to make sure you're still viable, hopefully, to work with another agent once you found a way to part ways, which is why I wanted to ask you about this, because you do have videos available where you discuss this, and good for you for going out there and letting anybody that might be in a similar situation or a worse situation know that, hey, you're not alone. This happens, and you're really, really good at agent finding. I watched a whole video where you explained Query Tracker to me in a way that was, oh, that's how I should have been using Query Tracker. What have I been doing?
That's funny. I'm sure you did a great job because you're doing great.
But so, thank you. Something like that, obviously, that's got to be a huge point of discouragement. And we're going to move on because you have so many encouraging things going on that I want to talk about. But in that moment where you found out this has happened to you, how do you dust yourself up, you know, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and get back in there? Because obviously we're talking about the debut novel that's released. You didn't let that end your career. Did you take a week and just deal with how bad you felt afterward? Or was it just put that away, can't do anything about it? How did you recover from that?
It was a couple different things. I think actually my initial thought was relief because I thought, okay, this agent left me. And so then that means maybe I can bring it to another agent and I wouldn't have that same like stigma with the book. So that was my initial like thought, was like relief. But then after I actually talked to some other authors who were working with this agent, and I just felt, I just realized they all were feeling the same way that I was feeling, and no one wanted to say anything. And it really crushed me because I was having a really, really hard time dealing with submission. I think submission by itself is a hard thing. It's almost harder than querying, I think, because you're like, with querying, you have a chance to change it up, and there's so many agents that you could work with. With submission, you're like really putting your book into the publisher's hands. And once they've rejected it, it's sort of like a rejection forever, kind of. So I think submission by itself is a hard time. So on top of that, having a difficult relationship with someone you're working with business-wise, it was hard. So I really wanted to make sure that other people realized that, you know, this happens, things happen, it's okay, you don't have to let it kill your dreams, just get up. And I've actually had one person in particular come to me because she was really devastated, and it really hurt her, crushed her dreams a little bit that she had lost an agent after coming so far. And she just was like coming at me a couple months later, or even maybe it was a year later. She said, "I'm thankful that you have been so out and open about your journey and positive, because now I feel like I can start writing again." So I really feel like those are the things that make me want to share more. It's like, this is, we all feel so isolated, and we all feel like our experiences are unique, and they are, but you're not alone. So don't try not to feel like you're alone. And yeah, and I don't know how, but I had that in me. I was like, I have a chance to start new. I can do this still. But I also had other books. I was writing other books. I wasn't trying to put all my eggs in this one basket, but I just didn't want to give up on it. So I ended up submitting this book on a Twitter pitch contest, maybe like a month after I left Parted Ways with my agent. And that's eventually what brought me my book deal, was this Twitter pitch contest. So that was really cool. But yeah, I don't know where it came from. I just was like, dang, I want to do this so bad, so no one's going to stop me.
You are aptly named, Mrs. Hope. that must happen a lot for you with hopeful happenings, because you've got, you know, so many people following the channel and watching your videos. I'm sure, as we're speaking, videos that you've forgotten you recorded that are 4 or 5 years old are racking up all the views right now. People must reach out to you on a regular basis. That must make you feel wonderful to know that you are a trusted voice in the author community, and that people feel that they can turn to you for advice.
It is kind of nice. I feel a little bit more legit, like, not like I'm like I'm just writing stories in my spare time. Like, I do feel like if I'm going to spend so much of my life researching and practicing and writing and publishing, then I want other people to be able to you know, benefit from it if they can by watching. So yeah, it's kind of nice to be a little expert in at least a tiny portion of writing. I mean, I wouldn't call myself like an expert, but if I know a little more than someone else, then I can be that voice of knowledge and advice and help them out.
When you're putting together a video like how to make a mock-up picture book or anything advice related, you had a wonderful video about plotting your novel. How do you become an expert? Where do you gather your information that you're able to present it expertly?
I go through a bunch of different places. I'll read books. I actually have two with me right now. So Save the Cat Writes a Novel is one. This is what it looks like. And then another one that I really like for publishing is The Essential Guide to Getting Your Book Published. So this is another one. So I like actually get physical books, and Writer's Digest is another great place. So I'll get those physical books, and then on top of that, I'll do research online, I'll watch podcasts, I'll listen to, because there's publishing companies and agencies out there doing articles, blogs, videos, and they teach you things. So I can pull all of that information in, just like as if I was writing an essay, and come up with a little YouTube video and make it fun and give that information back.
Do you find that you go back and, I don't know if you go back and occasionally watch one of your old videos and like, oh yeah, that was great advice. I should definitely apply that now to my current situation.
I actually do that. Like, I know I make these videos for other people, but I also make them for myself because I forget, oh, okay, I'm starting another book. What am I supposed to do again? I forget. Where do I start? How do I do an outline? How do I do the first draft? Or world building, all that is, it's like really nice to go back on and remember the advice I've given other people. I actually watched
question. I have the old blog post that I'll read here. Said, wow, Paspy knew exactly what to do here. I wish he was here now.
Yeah, you're like impressed. Like, oh, dang, I knew that. Oh, that's awesome.
You should team up with that guy. He sounds smart.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and awesome. I was enjoying your Spotify writing playlist this afternoon. You and I have some of the same taste. You like to sit and listen to movie soundtracks. I have some of the same soundtracks, but different tracks. So, oh, I'll listen to your mix. And that will complement my writing nicely. How much use is that? I mean, is that your playlist that you listen to every writing session? Or
yeah, that's my Spotify playlist. I'll like pull all of these soundtracks from different movies or Auto Machine, I think it's called, or Audio Machine. Anyway, I listen to all of that. And sometimes I might listen to something else, but that's such a huge list that I can play something that I like from there. And sometimes I'll actually pick one that fits the mood of the scene that I'm writing, and then I'll just put it on repeat, because then I'm not really listening to it and my brain is not really thinking about what's happening in the song anymore, and I can just have it as background mood music. But it gets me in the mood, it gets me into the feeling of the characters and the setting, and I think it really helps. I know some people don't like having music, they like to write in silence, and I've done that too. Well, most of the time, I feel like music helps me a lot with getting in the mood.
Yeah, I think it depends on, you know, everybody's a little bit different how they like to write. But I think if it was like a brand new album by an artist that I really like with lyrics, I'm going to want to pay attention to understand the meaning of the song or what I'm going to think the song is about for the next 10 years until somebody says, you know, that song's actually about this. They go, oh. But I don't want to be listening to that while I'm trying to compose my own story. So a nice movie soundtrack, which is designed to be played over a story that you're telling, that makes a wonderful wall of noise to just block out the world, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. And I've even done, like, on YouTube, there's tons of things on YouTube, and even people have made, like, hour-long songs. So I've actually done noises as well. So this would not be on Spotify, but I've done like rain. If I'm like writing a scene in the rain, I will put rain on, like YouTube, look up rainstorm and then have that on the background, because then it just like feels like I'm there. Or jungle sounds or a tavern sound. Those things are all out on the internet that you can find, and it really does help me, at least.
You have a favorite song or a favorite soundtrack that's kind of your study throughout writing?
I really like this one Harry Potter song that is in like the last movie, and I think it's about I'm gonna be sounding like such a nerd right now. It's the scene when Harry is trying to get the diadem from the ghost. And at the same time, there's like a war going on at the castle.
Oh,
okay, that song that they're playing right there, where he's trying to talk to the ghost and figure out where it is, and at the same time, there's like a war going on. That's like one of my favorite songs to write too.
That was a series that started with an incredible theme from John Williams, and then had other amazing artists. I think Patrick somebody who composes all the music for Kenneth Branagh movies, amazing artist. That is a series that the music did not go down. You would think when you start with John Williams, it's all going to be downhill from there, but nope. It was consistently great through all 8 movies.
Yeah, oh man, she got so lucky to have John Williams, because he's a legend. But yeah, you're right. Later on in the movies, the music kind of fits where the movies are going, because the music becomes more epic and more dark, and so do the movies. So that's really cool.
There is a track called Fireworks from Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix that I think might be my favorite song from all of the movies, but who knows, they're all pretty good. And Noon from The Professional is a song I always recommend for writers of The Professional soundtrack. The track is called Noon, and I could write just about any tension scene to that, or whatever that's worth.
Oh, that's cool.
And then aside from Spotify, I mean, you've got all kinds of things that you're doing with social media. I know you've got a members newsletter, and you're giving away character profile templates for anybody that wants to go and sign up. Is that right?
Yeah, it's just like a simple template that you can use as inspiration, and you can edit it however you'd like. But I do really feel like it's important to know your character, and to know all of your characters. And so that's kind of a way to get to know them and figure out what they look like and figure out what their hobbies are. And once you really get to know your character, then when you put them in a scene, they kind of just come alive. And so it's actually easier and more consistent, also consistency, when you have it written down.
And these are templates that you use when you start a new story?
Not when I started, but because like at the beginning, I learned the hard way that I was doing it wrong. And so I had to learn through it. But definitely I do have these templates now for my characters. That's kind of how I keep track of them, because there's actually a lot of characters in this book. And then for other books as well, I create these profiles for them. And it's especially helpful when I've left a project, because when I come back to it after, who knows, months, maybe years, I can go and read not just the story, but I can read the character profiles and see, oh yeah, this is what they are, this is what they look like, this is the past that I created for them, and how that past would affect their future, or the way that they talk, or the way that they act. And all that just kind of like comes back, and you don't have to make it up again.
So for all the folks that are right now rushing to sign up for your newsletter, because I want to get those templates, what else can they expect to receive? How often do you send out notices to your newsletter, and what do you find are the best uses for your mailing list?
Well, I do also offer a world-building template as well. It's sort of like a similar thing with characters, except it's just, you know, what's your world? What does it look like? Different things about like the period and all that, just something to put in there, because it doesn't even matter if you're writing fantasy or if you're writing a book set in modern day Texas. You need to do research, and it's a lot easier if you have that research written down, because then you don't have to redo the research every single time you write. So that's one thing that they can find on there. And then I don't try to like spam people with tons of emails. So they'll probably get an email from me, a newsletter email from me once a month or once every 2 months. And it's just like updates. Lately, it's been a lot of things about Sea of Kings and different contests they could have participated in up to the release of Sea of Kings. And then just different things that I'm doing. Like I will put, you know, this podcast would go in my newsletter so that they can watch it, and other appearances that I've made on interviews, or I'll be a judge soon on a writing thing, and don't ask me what the name of it is because I just forgot. But I'm doing like a bunch of different things. So the newsletter is just kind of like a way to keep people informed, give them the resources they need if they're interested in writing, but also even if they're not interested in writing, they can still come to the newsletter and just learn more about me and my books and my writing.
I mean, presumably anybody that's signing up for the Melissa Hope newsletter wants to know more about Melissa Hope, so it's good that you're sending them all this information.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope that this can keep us connected, like as a community. And definitely those subscribers are going to be the first to know important information, like if there's a book two or if I get another book deal, you know, like those kind of things, they'll be the first to know.
And aside from YouTube, where we all agree that you're killing it, and the newsletter, which sounds like a tremendous value, what other social media platforms have you found you're getting the most bang for your buck on?
I do really like using Instagram. That's probably the one I use the most. I just feel really comfortable on there for some reason, and I like message people there a lot, and I can connect with people there the most. But I do also have Twitter, and I do also have Facebook. I just am on there less. But I'm trying to be on all the platforms because I know people are not usually on all the platforms. Some people only want to have a Facebook account, or some people only want to use Instagram. So I do try to be on all of them just so that I can reach different audiences.
Yeah, I kind of have pulled way back from Twitter. So if you're following me on Twitter, look forward to my about one or two tweets a week reminding you of whoever came on the podcast, and once in a while, if I really like a movie trailer, I might comment on that. But otherwise, like I've made comments about which Batman is the best, and then I'll have, you know, 30 replies, and well, that's my afternoon.
Well, hey, you're more popular on Twitter than I am, that's for sure.
Well, that's a lot. Say something dumb about pop culture that's not dumb, just like, who cares? Like, if you don't feel that Michael Keaton is the best Batman, you're wrong, but that's cool. Go enjoy your Batman. Live your life. I'll live mine. It's fine.
That's so funny. That's awesome. Yeah, Twitter is really good for some things, but you have to, like, be careful with how you spend your time on all these different platforms. And I know people who love Twitter, and that's all they use. And I know a lot of other people who have a hard time with it. And I think as an author, if you want to pursue writing, Twitter is a really good place to go because there are a lot of agents and editors on Twitter. But that doesn't mean that you need to be like throwing yourself out there. But following all these people is nice. It's helpful. It's cool to be connected.
Oh yeah, I still read Twitter on a regular basis, almost like I get done reading the news and then I read a few tweets. All right, well, that's what's going on in the world.
Do you sometimes learn things from the news from Twitter first instead of like the actual news?
Oh sure, yeah, Twitter's much, much faster. They'll have video up of whatever the event is and everything else before CNN has updated their site.
Yeah, me too.
My wife is really great with Twitter. She works in tech for a living, and she will get mad at the news. She's like, "What? We knew about that 30 minutes ago. What are you guys doing? You're supposed to be reporters."
Oh, that is funny. Yeah, it's crazy how social media, what social media, what role it plays in our lives. It's crazy to see how involved we all are on these different platforms. I think it's really cool and beneficial for the most part. And so news is one that's really funny that she said that.
I think that there is something about trying to imagine the past. It becomes harder and harder for me to think of a time where folks didn't have the whole world in their pockets, where all the world's information that most of the world's information is available at the tips of your fingers, as opposed to going back to if your town didn't have a library, best of luck.
I know. I was even just thinking about this the other day, like, do I even remember what it was like not to have the internet like as such a huge part of my life, or having a phone that can connect me to the whole world, you know? Like, it's crazy to think what people were doing before. It's hard to remember. I do remember, but I'm like old enough to remember, but it's like fading.
I remember having to, I wanted to watch the trailer for Batman and Robin because there was no way that movie was going to disappoint me. And to download it, I had to start it. And then it took overnight. And then the next morning, oh, buddy, here comes 2 minutes of sweet, sweet Batman action I could watch the next day. After, and then, of course, my dad went ballistic. Like, you left our internet running all night? Like, yeah, that's how the only way I could get the trailer. You know, the phone was like, I'm an old man reminiscing about his youth on the internet.
That's so funny. So did it disappoint or was it awesome for you?
The trailer was looked like it might be a good movie. And then it was, you know what? I have watched that movie more times now than I have watched genuinely good movies. So who's to say?
That's a good movie then. If you want to watch it one more time, even just one more time, it's good.
Well, I'm the ideal audience for anything superhero because, like, I'll put up with a whole lot. If you just give me a taste of that what I came for, I'll put up with, you know, 20 minutes of terrible dialogue and unbelievable plot, but then Batman punches Mr. Freeze, and that's what I wanted. So I'm good.
So do you feel like books are the same, where you can finish a book even if you're not fully invested in everything about it? If you can get like that taste of what you like, would you feel like you're committed to books the same way you could be committed to a movie?
Yes and no. I am very patient with books. Back when I wrote reviews at the site, my policy was I left the negative criticism I left that out of the review. I am a little bit more forgiving because I understand that writing a story is hard, but it is harder for me to shut off that part of my brain that's always trying to learn as I'm writing that, hey, how could this have been better? Where would this maybe have been improved? Whereas with a movie, like, you know, if I'm watching Godzilla versus Kong, I will be on my phone reading Twitter, reading part of a book. But then when they start fighting, let's put that aside. All the people are done talking. Let's just watch the punchy, smashy bits. And it's a little bit more difficult to do that with a book.
That's so funny. So you read books while you watch movies?
Yeah. Yeah, if they're not worth really paying attention to. I've reached a point where I feel like when you get past adolescence and the movies stop being actively marketed towards you, it's easier to block out a lot of them and to feel like I've definitely seen a version, 5 versions of that movie before, and I'm sure this one will be nice as well. But depending on the movie, I don't necessarily need to watch all of it. Like, I wish they would release Transformers movies where they cut out all the people. Just give me the 30 minutes of the robots that you're actually going to put in there. I don't need Marky Mark pretending to be a scientist. Cut that. Let's just, the robot punch. And then we can all go home in 30 minutes and be fine.
Oh, that's so funny. You're like the opposite of me then.
Are you hardcore? You have to sit and watch every last moment?
I'm like zoned in. And even if I don't even like it, for some reason, I just like zone in to a screen. So I really, it's either like I'm watching it or I'm not watching it. I can't do both. I would never be able to read a book and watch a movie time because I would just be watching the movie.
Do you rewatch films, or do you are you one and done?
Do I watch films?
Yeah. Do you rewatch them? Back and understand how the story was told, or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. I love dissecting movies, so I'll watch them and then I'll watch them again for other reasons if I like them. But I also watch them again just to figure out, okay, where was the inciting incident? Where was the midpoint? And like when I'm watching a movie for the first time, I'll always pick up, okay, I think that was the inciting incident, or I think that was the midpoint, because the midpoint is a part in the story where, for like anyone listening right now who doesn't know what the heck I'm talking about, a midpoint is in the middle of, in the exact 50% of the story, there's like a moment where they change. And it's really interesting because in the first half of the story, a lot of things happen to the character. And then in the second half of the story, the character is actively making the changes. So I really like to pick up on those moments when I'm watching a movie for the first time. So I'll figure out, okay, I think this is a midpoint, and then I'll pause it and see how close I am. And a lot of the times I'm pretty close, because movies are very to the T. Like, you can pretty much count that it will be within like 10 minutes of the exact middle that they've done the midpoint. Books, I do it too, but it's a lot easier to know when I'm holding a book if I'm halfway through or not.
My mom was a retired dental hygienist, and she would complain. And since becoming a dental hygienist, anytime she went someplace, she would be looking at people's teeth, trying to determine what their brushing habits would be, which would get in the way of conversation, because normal non-dental hygienist people, I assume, don't walk around unless somebody's got teeth that are just, you know, you can't help but notice. You don't pay a great deal of attention to this part of the entire package as you're looking at their whole face, but she would just zoom in on those. I feel like that's similar for writers when it comes to stories. And movies are great for plot because you get the whole thing tightly contained in 2 hours. Whereas a book, it may be a couple of days before you're done, and there's going to be a lot of other things going on that, you know, what a beautiful description. How'd they do that? How did they create this suspense here? Let me go back and check that. When I kind of checked out of, I was supposed to be watching that midpoint, but I got distracted by this other amazing thing the author's doing.
So I don't know. I think that I look at movies differently. I don't know if I enjoy them less or more, but I do look at them differently. I'm not so oblivious now to when I watch. I'm a lot more like thinking while I'm watching.
It's a little bit difficult for me. The other thing that I like about books as opposed to movies is books, I can imagine whoever the character is, where they're going to have to cast somebody, and it's probably going to be somebody famous. Like, there was a trailer for a Matt Damon movie where he plays like hardworking, I don't know, he's like a salt of the earth, just regular guy. Stillwater, I think, was the trailer I just saw. But it's Matt Damon. It's like, okay, well, I appreciate that you're putting on a hat and like a flannel shirt and you look like you just worked a hard day, but I know you were palling around with Ben Affleck and you got out of a limo and you had a wonderful time right up to where you go to shoot the movie. And I almost feel a little bit condescended to when I see Tom Hanks play another everyman role. Like, man, you own a vineyard. Don't tell me about your money problems in the movie. It's a little bit hard for me to distract the performer from the character, whereas with the book, whatever the author wrote, it's happening in my head. So I have my input. That's also why I feel horror is far more effective in the written form than anywhere else, because a filmmaker can't add that childhood trauma that happened to you, but you're going to add it in with whatever the horrific thing is, and it's going to scare you all the more in a unique way because you're participating and freaking yourself out.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't think I've ever thought like that maybe I have, where I've been really bothered by the character or the actor, and that's taken away from the story. But I do love that books just don't have that. You know, everything's in your head. Everything that the character experiences and feels, you feel it a lot more when you're reading versus when you're watching.
Melissa Hope, have you ever seen A Flying Saucer and or a Ghost?
I have not. Although I have definitely creeped myself out thinking that I've seen a ghost, but I have not seen a ghost or a flying saucer. Have you?
Not a flying saucer. I did see a ghost, but I've learned from previous episodes that it's not a great movie story. So whenever I've told it, I cut it out. But yes, I have seen something that I believe had some form of supernatural origin.
And does that affect your writing or life?
It doesn't affect, it affects my writing because it affects my outlook on the world. I have seen enough evidence that there is something suspicious about the world. Which, of course, is the basis of most religions. Hey, there's something else going on here on top of the physical world that some folks can identify down to how everything's working and how the universe functions. I'm not quite comfortable with that, but I can definitely see that there's obviously more than we can see just with our naked eye happening all around us, which makes sense. We've got five senses. I'm sure that there are far more required to observe everything.
Yeah. I do feel like there's definitely something else there. And I feel like even if you haven't seen anything, you can still kind of sense that there's something else. So that's, I don't know if it's cool for you that you've seen a ghost or if it's creepy, but but I want to hear the story.
It's creepy, but it's nice to have just little bits of evidence that, and I feel this way, and it's only about the last year with the pandemic, and now that we're coming out of it. There's been enough suddenly positive news everywhere. My wife and I are now both fully vaccinated. We're getting back to our lives in small ways beyond just meeting with people online. We're doing some porch visits and things. It's like, oh, look at this. The sun is shining again. And it's not all bad. And it does feel like it feels like evidence of God.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice. Well, it would be nice for you to be able to work from home doing these podcasts. But I'm really glad that we're getting out of it. And it would be nice to meet with people in person again.
Yeah, no, from a podcasting perspective, it's terrible. Once all these authors can go back to events in person, why will who's going to talk to me on Zoom? No. But you know what? That's a sacrifice I'm willing to make if that means the whole world can get back in motion again.
I'm sure you have no problems at all. Everybody still listens to podcasts, and everybody loves to hear from their favorite agent or editor or author. So, and awesome. We love hearing from you too. I was actually just listening to your latest podcast. It was with an author and an illustrator, and I'm forgetting their names right now, but they are the author illustrator too.
Picture book. Marcella and Mike Quinica.
Yeah, I think so. And they published Moo.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's them.
I loved that book, and I just thought it was so clever, especially because there's like no. There's no writing in it at all. It's mostly told through the pictures and this word moo. So I thought it was really cool to just hear their perspective on their careers and working together. So yeah, I mean, it may happen that there'll be less online events because the world starts opening up, but I don't think there'll be any less viewers for you.
Oh, I'm sure I'll be fine. I was being facetious and having just a little bit of fun. No, I'm thrilled that the world is opening back up and we're all going back out. I'm still probably going to be a little bit hesitant for a while. I don't know when I'll feel comfortable going to a public place and wearing a mask. A movie, I miss movies so much, but the thought of sitting in a theater, and if I hear one person cough, it's going to be like, ooh. Probably for a little while. Have you been able, I know Florida has been open for a while. Have you been able to get back out in the world yet?
It's yes and no. Like I've been out, I go shopping and I've been to the beach, which is nice and outside. But I did also just have a baby and then I was pregnant before that. So getting out in general with three little kids is difficult. And then now that I've got like a newborn, I'm still kind of nervous about her being around other people, but I feel like I'm getting out there as much as I would any other time. I don't know. I like I said before, I could stay home and all day and pretty much be okay with it. Like that's just my personality. But with little kids, I do try to get out and go outside a lot.
It does seem like possibly, I mean, the pandemic has hit us all, but it does seem like it's maybe impacted a lot of writers less than maybe other artists. like stage performers, I'm so sorry this has to have been just a tremendously difficult time for you, or comedians, anything where you involved people being there in person. But for writers who were at home most days anyway, that is dramatic a change, I think.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of good things about being a writer during a pandemic. I know that it's affected some people with, well, it has affected some people negatively with, I've personally known a few who got their book contracts canceled because publishing companies weren't as doing as well or whatever. And then like school visits aren't happening anymore. But overall, it's a good time to be a writer when you can just shut yourself in a little house and got nothing else to do. We're right.
Well, that depends on the writer. I know some folks, even they have the time to write. It's sort of like that old Twilight Zone episode where the woman always wants time to read and never want to be quiet so she can read, and then everybody, I think, dies. And so she's there with her books, and she finally got time to read, and then her glasses break, and so she can't read. And so I feel that's a little bit true for writers during the pandemic. As you're at home, you finally got time to write. Good thing there's this crippling existential dread that's going to consume your thoughts at the time while you're trying to write.
Yeah, that's true. So did you get writing done during this whole last year, or do you feel like your regular work schedule was different?
Well, I was at half capacity at best, because my schedule had been around my son being in school, and then, you know, I've been homeschool all year, and that has been fine. I will not regret the book that maybe the extra book and a half that I would have gotten done, because I've been able to spend so much time with him and help him with his education and get more directly involved with his teachers. I feel that's a good trade.
Awesome. And kudos, because my kids are not in school yet, so I don't even know how parents have been handling homeschooling their kids. So my hat's off to you.
Oh, well, thank you. I've got a brother who's got 3 and a sister who's got 4. So of the of the burdens being lifted by the kids this year, pretty light year. Well, I'm watching our time, and I know you've got 3 kids so that I had promised to get you off of here in order to return to, so I don't want to take up more of your time as you've been so gracious with. I do want to encourage everybody to go to your YouTube channel, to Hopeful Happenings, and subscribe immediately after you subscribe to this, of course. And thank you, Melissa, for making the time and for being such a wonderful guest. My last question is always some variation of, if you could go back toward the start of your writing career, the middle, anywhere in your writing career that you like, and give yourself some advice that maybe would have made a difference for you and might make a difference to everyone who's watching or listening to this, what would you go back and tell yourself?
I would throw my copy of Save the Cat at my past self and be like, read this book. But I think I just tell past me to be patient, because publishing is really slow. And I think patience is really key. You don't work any less, but being able to work through those slow times and not let it get to you, I think is important. So be patient.
I love this idea of a time portal opens and a book flies out and hits you in the face. Ow. Wait, was that me? What the?
Did I just see a past? No.
This looks like a pretty good book, though. That would be a good afternoon. Where can esteemed audience find you online, follow you on social media, all that good stuff?
They can find me on Instagram at Hopeful Happenings, YouTube Hopeful Happenings, and Twitter Hopeful Happens. I also have a website, authormelissahope.com.
As always, esteemed audience, head to middlegradeninja.com for all the best interviews with all the best people, everything that's good in this world. Download your free copy of Vanneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees. And God willing, I'm alive. I'll see you next week.
Thanks, Rob.